Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18+, begambleaware.org, T's and C's apply.
This is a Game Day podcast from TalkSport.
Hello and welcome to the Premier League post-match podcast with Republic of Ireland and Ipswich legend Matt Holland, TalkSport transfer guru Alex Crook and me, Sam Matterface. Frank gets curt with Zouma after centre-back almost hands Tottenham the game after Chelsea dominate Derby Day draw with old foe. Heading in the right direction, Cavani comes off the bench to rescue Manchester United at St Mary's, and it doesn't get any better for Arteta as Arsenal make their worst start to a season in the Premier League ever. Also this week, it's 8-8 for Diogo, but Liverpool don't get a lotter despite a super goal from Jota. But was it really a gross injustice? Newcastle score two goals, Burnley get bullied, and Sheffield United are officially the bluntest blade since the invention of a butter knife. All that and a look ahead to Monday night's action on the podcast that has the drip of Calvert-Lewin and the sauce of Tom Davis. It's the Game Day Premier League post-match pod from TalkSport.
This is Game Day.
Hello to Matt Holland. How are you?
Good evening. Very well indeed. Yourself?
Yes, very good. Thank you very much. And Alex Crook commentated on his own team this week. How are your emotions? A roller coaster ride through the journey that is life under Solskjaer?
Yeah, there are a few pens flying through the commentary booth in that first half, I have to be honest. But obviously Ollie made the positive change at half time, bringing on Cavani, who should have started the game, and not for the first time, coming from 2-0 down to win 3-2 at St Mary's.
Funny that there was pens being thrown about the commentary box, because actually the miracle was that this week there was no pens in a Manchester United game.
Yeah, they can score from open play. Do you know my favourite stat from that game? Jan Bednarek scored for Southampton. It's his third goal in three different games. In every game in which he scored, they've been 2-0 up at half time and lost 3-2.
That's terrible news. Oh dear. He won't want to. They won't want him on the score sheet again, will they?
I mean, would you stopping going up for corners?
Do you go into dressing rooms after games like that and say, Jan, just stop scoring for us?
I mean, that is incredibly unlucky for him, isn't it?
Yeah. Matt, what would you do in that situation? Would you just say to him, look, mate, it's probably better just hang around the edge of your own 18-yard box?
Probably just leave him out. I mean, Crookie, honestly, I saw your tweet at half time, actually. You said United was so bad, it's laughable. I actually totally disagree with you. United played all right.
I agree with you, yeah. Yeah, I actually
think they actually played all right.
Let's get to it. I'll tell you what, let's first of all listen to some of his commentary if we can, and then we'll have a little look back at what actually happened during the game.
Lurking on the edge of the area, whipped it towards the goalkeeper and headed in by Jan Bednarek. Southampton, with virtually their first shot on target, take the lead.
Try and double Southampton's lead. Right footed, and it's in.
No.
James Ward-Prowse doing what James Ward-Prowse does, but David De Gea has had an absolute nightmare in the Manchester United goal, having got across to his near post. He can only push it into the back of the net, and Southampton, with 13 minutes to go until half-time, lead Manchester United by 2-0.
Here's Cavani, right-hand side of the area, crosses, Fernandes shoots and scores, and Manchester United are back in the game. United trail, punched away by McCarthy, only as far as Fred, and Fernandes shoots, deflected, and Cavani equalises for Manchester United, the flying header.
And from 2-0 down, It is Southampton 2, Manchester United 2. He points to the name on the back of his shirt. Edinson Cavani. Rashford's cross. Cavani's header! And Manchester United have won the game with his second of the afternoon. The comeback is complete for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
I'm with Matt. United had not played particularly badly before Cavani's introduction, but they look so much more accomplished with him on the field. I don't think anyone would argue against that. They just took their chances, for one. What I was really concerned about was in the first half was how many they missed. I mean, Rashford played through the middle, missed chances. Greenwood had a one-on-one, missed chances. Bruno Fernandes missed chances, even when they were being gifted opportunities by Alex McCarthy in that first half an hour of the game, Matt Holland. They did create.
They did. I mean, so I don't think Southampton played very well at all.
No.
You know, when you've got someone of the quality of James Ward-Prowse, obviously you can cause opposition teams problems, and that's exactly how it panned out. He set the first one up from the corner, scored the second, but United played okay, I thought, and did create chances and opened up Southampton quite regularly in that first half. It was a different team, though, with Cavani on. I've always admired him. In terms of, I think he misses, he's actually someone that misses a lot of chances, Cavani, when I've watched him throughout his career. But I've always admired his work rate and his intelligence. And I think that came to the fore in the second half for United. And I thought his first goal was a true goal scorer's goal. When you watched it, he was the only one on the move in the box. He was the only one that was anticipating where that ball might go. And I thought he was excellent when he came off the bench.
I was sitting next to Andy Cole throughout the course of the game, and he was bemoaning the lack of movement before Cavani came on to the field of play. And funnily enough, actually, it was interesting to hear Ole Gunnar Solskjaer afterwards compare the movement of Cavani to Andy Cole. He said, he reminds me of Andy in the way that he sort of moves inside the box and causes all sorts of problems. I was also a little bit concerned about Wan-Bissaka, who was getting zero protection in that right back area, mainly because Manchester United were playing a midfield quartet in a very odd shape. It turns out, in the crook, I suppose, that the diamonds aren't always forever.
No, it didn't work, the diamond. But we could have predicted that before the game, because the one thing you know about Southampton is they're going to be combative in midfield. They're going to try and keep it tight. So the diamond was never going to work, because it just took away any natural width that United had and the chance to get in behind the Southampton fullbacks, who do love to get forward. And that's the one area of the team where probably you can exploit them. And certainly in the second half, Wan-Bissaka was much more effective bombing on down that right-hand side. Actually put some good crosses into the area as well. I think his end product and his creativity is improving. Week by week, there's never been any question about his defensive abilities, but it's going the other way where maybe he's lacking behind some of his modern contemporaries. But he had a good game in the second half. Van der Beek saw more of the ball in the second half as well and had a growing influence. Matic and Fred, for me, didn't really work. And I think it's an interesting one now, because we've seen in midweek and we've seen in this game, they're a better team with Cavani as the focal point, but it's how you fit in all of those other players. Martial didn't take part in the game because he fell sick at the team hotel. Rashford was a little bit off the pace, I thought, and obviously Greenwood would have been very disappointed to be taken off at half time. So it will be fascinating now to see how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer sets his team up next weekend against West Ham.
Does he deserve credit, Matt Holland, for changing it and turning the game around?
Yeah, he does. I mean, as I say, I didn't think they played particularly bad in the first half anyway. I mean, I've just said that anyway, but it needed freshness. It needed something at halftime. And obviously Cavani provided that. So he does deserve credit for that. Eight away wins on the spin now in the Premier League. The way they play does suit being away from home. You know, they are genuinely a good counter-attacking team, and being away from home, it suits them more, using their pace on the break, trying to break teams down. We've seen at home it's been a more difficult task for them at times. Interesting as well, wasn't it? You know, we talked about Cavani, but there was another half-time change for United, and Dean Henderson coming on in goal as well, and that is going to be interesting in the weeks going forward as well, because although he didn't have a lot to do, he was very composed, accomplished in what he did have to do, and vocal as well. And I think that's quite important. You know, United are quite a quiet team. And when you've got, you know, a bit of a voice at the back as well, I think that makes a difference. So it's going to be interesting in the next couple of weeks what he does, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, with his goalkeepers.
Well, it was interesting. I think that it was an injury, the reason that he brought off David De Gea. I don't think anyone was really apportioning him much blame for the James Ward-Prowse free kick, were they?
No, it was. I mean, it was an injury, but he bashed his knee into the post, and it was quite clearly an injury that prevented him coming back on the pitch. But
the reason I raised this, Matt, is because there was a commentator who did blame the goalkeeper, I think. Was there, Crook?
I thought De Gea could have done better. I wasn't convinced by his starting position and having got across.
All right, well, stop there for a second.
He could have been stronger in terms of trying to save the shot.
Let me just ask Matt. I think the wall was set up to protect that side of the goal, and therefore it was the wall's job to stop it from getting that far. And he was on the other side, protecting the other side of the goal. And for him to get over to the ball was difficult enough. And I don't think it would have been difficult. I think it was too difficult for him to drag it back.
I've got to be honest, I don't think a wall can stop James Ward-Prowse. And I say that in a way that the goals he scored, I think at Aston Villa, the one of the goals that he scored was right on the edge of the box. And to get that up and over the wall and down in time to score was, you know, unbelievable. So I don't think the wall actually does much anyway when James Ward-Prowse is over the ball. If anything, you'd almost be better at not having one and letting the goalkeeper see it all the way. I don't know. I think we're getting to that point with him. He's got so much quality that you're almost better just not having a wall and letting the goalkeeper see it all the way.
Okay. I just don't think that you can say it was his fault that the goal went in. I think ultimately you've got to acknowledge that James Ward-Prowse is a supreme being when it comes to set piece execution, and we just have to doff our cap and say, look, you know, this is a special talent, and it comes through hard work, doesn't it? I mean, you've spoke to him a lot, Crook. He's someone who has honed this technique over many a year.
Yeah, right back when Southampton were first promoted to the Premier League, I remember speaking to him at their Staplewood training ground, and he said that he spends hours practicing and watching videos of David Beckham, actually, and you can see big similarities between the way that he stands, his stance, and the way he strikes the ball as David Beckham. Only David Beckham, in terms of English players, have now scored more goals direct from free kicks than James Ward-Prowse. He's level with Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard, I think, with 9. Beckham's got 18, so still some way to go. But Matt's absolutely right. And actually, in commentary, I said to Paul Parker, David De Gea will be prepared that this shot is going to be on target, because Ward-Prowse's free kicks are almost always on target.
That's true. I spoke to Theo Walcott on Friday night, and he said this Saints team is one of the best he's played in. The spirit and unity is very, very good, he said. And that was there to be seen. They are a good side. Hassan Hüttl said afterwards he thinks they're getting better and better and better. I don't think they were as good today as I've seen them previously, and I think that they can improve. But they've got the makings of a very good team, Matt.
Yeah, I like them. I think they have got the makings of a decent team. They miss Danny Ings when he's not in the side. You know, some of the goals that he scores from positions that you're probably not expecting him to score from at times as well. And when you've got a player like that in your team, you're always likely to give or get to win points. So there is a good organisation about them. There's a good pace about them. But I agree with you. I don't think they played particularly well today. And actually, United deserved to win.
Let's move on to Arsenal against Wolves. The latest on Raul Jimenez being that he is up and conscious, but he was taken off during that game after what was a sickening clash of heads between him and David Luiz. And when you watch it without the extra crown effect, you can hear the sound of the two heads smashing together. It's a horrible, it's a frightening sound. What troubled me, maybe even more than the Raul Jimenez thing, because they took him off straight away and he went off to hospital, was the fact that David Luiz came back onto the field of play.
Yeah, I agree. And you could see that the blood never stopped. It was constantly pouring from that head wound and coming through to the bandage. The fact they've taken him off at half-time, for me, is a clear indication that he was concussed. And I think it was a neglect of duty of care for the player that he stayed on in the first place. And I'm not convinced we've heard the end of that, because we know the Premier League are trying to enforce much stricter concussion protocols, and I don't think they were adhered to. I do wonder if we're getting to the stage now, because obviously the final decision is with the Arsenal club doctor, and clearly it was in Arsenal's interest to keep David Luiz on the pitch. Do we almost need an intermediary, a neutral doctor, to make that decision?
I think actually when the new rules are published on June the 1st this year, there will be a concussion substitute that is allowed, in which you can take a player off for 5 minutes for a proper assessment by an independent doctor.
It's a difficult one for me to talk about this, because as a player that regularly got cuts and regularly was bandaged up in games to carry on, I had stitches at half time in matches, I've had bandages, I've had cuts. It's a difficult one because, you know, ultimately I wanted to play, and it, you know.
Were you ever concussed?
No, so I was always fine in that respect. Obviously, our thoughts now with Raul Jimenez as well, and hopefully he's okay, because it was a sickening clash, and my mind immediately went to Ryan Mason. You know, someone who suffered a serious head injury in the past, and I don't think there was any blood in that incident either. And Raul Jimenez, I don't think was cut either. It was the noise and the fact that he was down for so long. My thought immediately went to Ryan Mason, and fingers crossed, Raul Jimenez is going to be okay.
Because that was
great character from Wolves, by the way. Because, you know, it would have affected the Wolves players as teammates, and Nuno as his manager. Difficult, I'd imagine, Matt, in those circumstances, to keep your focus on the game. That they managed to do that and grind out a victory, I think is testament to their mental toughness as well.
Yeah, it was horrible. It, when something happens like that on the pitch, I think from both sets of players, actually, you know, it's sickening to see. And you know, I think the players were affected by it immediately in the aftermath of the incident. But I thought Wolves were worthy of the 3 points as well. And the Pedence goal was just a thing of beauty, wasn't it? You know, that little bit of skill, the way he dinks it over the goalkeeper and Gabriel, sorry. And I thought it was a fabulous goal from him. And Wolves were thoroughly deserving of the 3 points as well.
In the words of Dominic Calvert-Lewin, did it have sauce and drip, or just drip, or just sauce?
What? Yeah, I had a bit of sauce and a bit of drip. I thought it was that good.
Yeah, okay. Certainly, Mikel Arteta is looking like a bit of a drip, isn't he? Because a year after the dismissal of Unai Emery, they've made their worst start to a Premier League season ever. Perry Groves texted me on the full-time whistle and he went, "I hate football. Football is dead. It's over." They're not playing very well either, are they? I mean, they've scored 2 goals in 6 league games. And they've got a very expensively assembled strike force. What does he do here? I mean, because he's got to take some blame, Matt, because tactically, the framework is so rigid, it sort of constricts their forward players, doesn't it?
Do you know, when he's come in, the first thing he's done is say, we're going to put a structure in place. We're going to make it more difficult for teams to break us down. We're going to be harder to beat. And I can understand that, because they were a team that were very open, gave you a chance. And I could understand his thoughts, thinking we need to sort that end of the pitch out, because going forward we're going to score goals. That's no problem at all. But actually, by sorting out the defence and trying to be more difficult to break down, he's taken away from some of the attacking play.
But you have to be flexible, don't you? And you have to recognise that. And it was pretty clear to see. I mean, I've spoken to him about it. He said he didn't want to play like the way he played in the FA Cup semi-final or the FA Cup final forever. He wanted to develop the team so that they could play with a bit more flair. But that, I haven't seen that, Alex.
No, me neither. And what's surprising me most is that the majority of Arsenal fans still seem firmly in the Arteta in camp. I mean, you've mentioned that stat. They've got their fewest number of points, 10 games into a Premier League season. He's got a worse record than Bruce Rioch and indeed Unai Emery, who was dismissed arguably for far less, you know, far better performances than what we've seen this season under Mikel Arteta.
I thought we should look back at that through rose-tinted glasses. I mean, it was pretty incoherent under Emery as well.
Yeah, what would worry me is the body language, in particular of Aubameyang. He to me looked like a player who's got the weight of the world on his shoulders today. He's clearly not enjoying his football. I don't think he had a single shot on target in this game. Arsenal as a team didn't have a shot on target in the second half, and I think he's only had 13 shots on target, Aubameyang, over the course of the campaign. So it's not like he's missing chances. The team aren't creating for him.
Yeah, I mean, it might not be the weight of the world. It might just be the weight of the salary in the backpack if they're paying paying him in cash.
I don't think he's down tools because he's on massive money.
I just don't think the team is set up in a way. I don't think the team is set up in a way to serve him or serve anybody else in that front line, which is a problem, Matt.
He's got to work out a way of getting the best out of him because he's his best player.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, when you're managing a team, you've got to work out who's going to win your games.
But you also have to make sacrifices, don't you? Because it's all right turning around and saying, I can't carry Mesut Ozil, so he doesn't give me enough work the other way, so I've got to bin him off. I can't carry Guendouzi because he's a loose cannon, so he's got to go off. I can't carry Bukayo Saka because he doesn't give me enough, you know, enough protection at the back. I've got to put more of a rigid structure in. You can't keep binning off players that give you creativity if you are not A, getting results, or even B, scoring any goals. You've got to come up with something.
Yeah, he's got to find a way of getting the best out of him. I mean, Crookie and I did their game in Europe, and he played Lacazette as a number 10. And I actually, I don't think Lacazette had his best game, but I actually thought the system worked quite well. And I thought that might be a way of getting the best out of Aubameyang as well. Clearly, he's better. You'd think he'd be better through the middle rather than out wide. You'd think he's going to get more chances if he plays through the middle rather than out wide. He's got to somehow find a way of getting the best out of him, and at the moment, he isn't.
Shall we turn our attention to Chelsea against Tottenham? 0-0, it finished at Stamford Bridge. They shared the spoils in a game where the Blues had a goal ruled out correctly for offside. Tottenham were presented with a real chance to steal it in the final moments when Zouma gives it to Lo Celso. What are you doing? But in the end, and I think this is true, I think both will be relieved that they didn't lose the game. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Chelsea did more to go and win it than Spurs did. You said about Zouma almost presenting Spurs with a winner. Well, actually, Spurs almost presented Chelsea with a winner because Rodon's header put Giroud in on goal, and he should have done better faced up with his international teammate Hugo Lloris as well. So they both sort of made mistakes near the end of the game. But I thought Chelsea did more to go and win it, and they'll probably be a bit more frustrated they haven't got the 3 points.
Jose Mourinho has helpfully sent an Instagram out in which he's got a picture of him and Hugo Lloris saying, "One shot, one save. Well done, Hugo. We're not happy, but that's the way we are. We showed great spirit."
I thought he might have put a picture up of a bus or something, and a back six of Sissoko and Højbjerg in that back four, those four centre backs as well, because that's what he did.
Yeah,
and he did it against Man City last week as well. He played Sissoko and Højbjerg so deep, and they were almost in the back four. And he did it again at Chelsea, but he's got 4 points from Man City at home and Chelsea away.
Absolutely. And you know, he'll play Arsenal next week, and he probably won't have to do that because they don't create any chances, so he could probably afford to leave the car park bare. But Chelsea did have more of the ball, 13 shots to 5. Spurs offered very little going forward in the second half, I thought. Mount was stopped by Lloris at the end as well. The Bergwijn chance was an okay one. Mendy saved it. I thought it was a routine save, actually. But both teams are starting to show that steel at the back. Crook, did they show you anything, and will they admit it themselves, that they are contenders for the division this year?
I think it's probably still too early to say. What I would suggest...
Ten games in now.
Yeah. What I would say is that I think Jose Mourinho showed that deep down, he is still a manager who in the big games is more concerned with not losing than he is with winning. And I wonder in this very
That's
congested...
That's an upgrade for Spurs though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I do wonder in this very congested, very tight season that come the crunch, when Jurgen Klopp is clearly a more positive coach and his first instinct is to try and win the game, I wonder if ultimately that will set Liverpool apart from Tottenham. But I would also ask the question, is there more pressure arguably on Chelsea to finish in the top four and challenge for the title, given that they qualified for the Champions League last season, the money they've spent, than Spurs? You could argue that Spurs actually are probably ahead in their development of maybe where Jose Mourinho expected them to be 10 games into the season.
There's a brilliant stat actually doing the rounds as a result of Jose Mourinho's taunts to Frank Lampard about the number of pounds that he has spent. Well, since Frank Lampard Lampard has been the manager of Chelsea since he was appointed the manager of Chelsea. Mourinho's Tottenham Hotspur have spent £238.5 million and sold £59.9 million worth of players, which means their net spend is £178 million. Chelsea's net spend for the same period is £24 million. So, I mean, it's pretty clear that Moneybags Chelsea is not the same Moneybags Chelsea as when he was in charge, and it was just mind games at the beginning of the game. But what do you think, Matt? Are they title contenders, both these two teams?
Yeah, I think we have to consider them as title contenders because, like you say, 10 games in now. If you look at the league table, Man City are in 10th, and they've got a game in hand on the teams at the top.
Which they'll win.
They're six points off the top, and win it, they're only 3 points away. It's the most open title race that we've seen for many a year. There's probably six or seven teams that will feel they're in with a chance of winning it.
I think Manchester City will be top by Christmas.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Mm. Okay, let's get on to Saturday, and a mood has descended on Merseyside.
We are off and underway under the beautiful blue skies down here in East Sussex. All over the top by Fabinho in towards Salah, edge of the area. First time strike towards the near corner, and it's narrowly wide of Matt Ryan's goal. And into the path of Mope, and he sends Connolly through in behind Fabinho and racing into the box. He shoots over the goalkeeper and just wide. What a chance for Brighton to take the lead. Connolly inside the area. Whoa, there's a tangle goal. Of legs.
Goal.
And there is a call for a penalty kick, and it's going to be a penalty for Brighton against Liverpool. Mope steps up, right-footed, sends it wide of the goal, and it's a huge miss. It's a huge miss from Neil Mope. Off to Salah, racing through the centre. Goalkeeper comes out, Salah puts it past him, and Liverpool lead by a goal to nil. I think this is going to be chalked off, you know. I think it's going to be a possible offside. It is a possible offside. I think it's going to be an offside goal. No goal. All into Salah, then on to Jota. Good touch. Takes it past two defenders. Right-footed shot towards the far corner and scores a terrific goal. It's an absolutely brilliant goal from the man of the moment, Diogo Jota, in towards the near post. Mane with a header. Terrific goal. Oh, they're checking another.
Well, I think it's going to be ruled out.
They're checking another one.
Yeah, just from my angle, it looked like it was offside.
Two goals they've had disallowed in the game. They're checking a possible penalty here for Brighton. And I've got to admit, we didn't see much wrong with this challenge on Welbeck, but he has caught his foot, and it is a penalty to Brighton. Here is Pascal Gross then, now as he finally steps up to take this penalty kick and slams it down the middle, and Brighton have equalised in the second minute of stoppage time. And it's Brighton 1, Liverpool 1 at full time.
Brighton 1, Liverpool 1. First of all, it's not a penalty. It's not a penalty in the real world. It's not. In the real world, it's not a penalty. It's never a penalty. But in the brainwashed football world of VAR, no contact, kiss chase, it is, because it's the same level of contact as Masuaku and Salah, which I don't remember Liverpool complaining about, but why would they? Does it pass the Adrian Durhamometer? Would you spill a pint of beer or drop a baby if you had that level of contact? The answer to that is quite clearly no. But it is still a penalty in the current climate, let's say. But forget that for a second. Forget the rant about broadcasters injuring James Milner, because they didn't do that. Liverpool had two shots on target in this game. Yes, two rightly disallowed goals as well. But two shots on target, Matt. Six off target. Brighton had 11 and 3. Liverpool didn't do enough to win this game in the first place.
Do you know what? One of the most surprising stats I saw before that game yesterday was Brighton have got the least expected goals against.
Yeah, because they don't face any shots. The problem is the goalkeeper keeps letting them in.
Well, I'm just saying. So Liverpool to have only two shots, that's because Brighton are actually, you know, not giving up too many opportunities.
Yeah, they don't.
So there's a you know, obviously a reason there, and that was a surprising stat to me. It was a day that, I guess in Jurgen Klopp's eyes, everything went wrong. The fact that he had the chat about the early kickoff and wasn't happy about that. James Milner then getting injured. Salah's reaction to being subbed as well. That didn't go down well.
You're never happy when you're subbed, though, are you?
No, absolutely. Well, he's greedy for goals, and he's greedy for the golden boot. Quite simple. And then giving up the penalty late on. So anything that could have gone wrong yesterday for Jurgen Klopp went wrong.
I don't want to pick up everything on what he said on Saturday, because I have a degree of sympathy with anyone who's injured, for a start. I just don't like the debate at this time when so many other people are suffering. Just play the songs and smile through it, folks. But Milner's injury. Klopp, who has complained about the lack of the five subs, made an unnecessary substitution at half-time, a tactical sub, when he takes off Nico Williams. He didn't need to do that. He could have replaced Milner at half-time with Henderson if he wanted to protect his older players. And Milner is the one that ends up getting injured.
I've got to be honest. I was doing the game yesterday, and 5 minutes before half-time, I said he's going to take Nico Williams off. He was struggling, and he struggled there last year as well. You could see it was a problem. And so, giving the penalty away, I thought it was an obvious sub to make at half-time. But I wouldn't mind giving a bit of credit to Brighton as well,
yes,
for their performance. Yeah. And actually, learning from previous mistakes, because this is a team that do like to play out from the back. They've overplayed out from the back. They keep trying to pass it out and give goals, yeah, away, and they've done it against the big boys regularly. Well, this time, do you know what they did? They bypassed, yes, that high press and played long, played Connolly, got in behind Liverpool on regular occasions. And actually, I thought Graham Potter has learned from previous mistakes and did a good job tactically yesterday.
There was a couple of times in the second half where I thought, careful, you're doing it again, don't do it. But apart from that, I thought it was very well managed, actually. And it was something we touched on Thursday on the preview podcast, that they couldn't do that this time around because they're playing the best pressing team in the country. Look, it's not all that bad for Liverpool. They're within touching distance of the top spot, and it could be worse. They could be Neil Mopé, who became the first player to start a Premier League game, miss a penalty, and be replaced before half-time since Dennis Bergkamp in 1998 against Derby.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Let's move on to Everton against Leeds. It's not gone particularly well. Everton recently, who after a bright start when they won 7 games on the trot at the beginning of the season, have found themselves victorious in just 1 of the last 6, and that was against Fulham. And they almost threw that away. This was a very good football match, though, wasn't it? I mean, Crook, Leeds were worthy winners, I thought, but what a match.
Yeah, I think football was the winner, to be honest. Two sides who tried to play the game in the right way, created plenty of chances. I actually think Jordan Pickford came out of the game with a lot of credit. He's obviously had his detractors this season, but he made some very important saves, particularly in the first half. But you're right, I think Leeds probably were the better team. A clean sheet will please Marcelo Bielsa because they've been hard to come by. But again, we saw with Everton, without Luca Dean, who was excellent in that win against Fulham, they do lack depth in squad, and I think ultimately that's going to be a problem for them this season. And Luca Dean is so important to what they do in terms of creating chances and the number of assists that he provides for the likes of Dominic Calvert-Lewin, that if he is going to be out, as Carlo Ancelotti has indicated, for the next 2 or 3 months, that's a major concern.
Everton have a week to prepare for the next Premier League game. It's against Burnley. You would expect them to get points in that game. They need to start getting points in a game somewhere because they've lost too many recently, and Carlo Ancelotti, I think, started to get a little bit irritated by the fact that they haven't been able to win matches, especially at home. They've lost the last 2 there.
I think their fan sights will be lowered now. I think with the start that they made to the season, one or two Evertonians perhaps were getting a bit carried away talking about the glory days of the 1980s coming back. There are so many good teams competing for that top four, top six. They'll probably still finish eighth, Everton. That's probably about where their level, I think, in the Premier League.
Leeds are going to go down to Stamford Bridge and beat Chelsea on the same day, 8 o'clock kickoff. That one, that's live on Talk Sport. In fact, both those games, Everton Burnley and Leeds against Chelsea, are on Talk Sport at 8 o'clock next Saturday. Talking of Burnley, Manchester City beat them by 5-0. Now, psychology, Matt, plays a big part in football. We know this. But Burnley have got a mental problem with Manchester City, haven't they? They are beaten before they go on the pitch. They've lost 7 of their last 10 Premier League games anyway, so they're not in particularly good form. But Manchester City have won their past 7 meetings with Burnley by an aggregate scoreline of 28-1. That, I'm afraid, is not normal, is it?
Well, it's mental block, but there's a massive gap in quality.
There is, but not everybody loses 5-0 every time they go there, which happens to Burnley.
Well, it was a banker, wasn't it? It lost the last two there 5-0. It was going to be 5. I mean, Bailey Peacock Farrell did his best to make it 6 and 7, but even he got away with those. So it was still their customary 5. The beating, City were good, weren't they? And they've been threatening to do it. I mean, I think, you know, they've not been quite as bad as some people have made City out to be.
They weren't scoring goals. That was a problem for them. And Kevin De Bruyne had a field day, didn't they?
Yeah, he did. He did. I thought he was excellent. Pulled strings, and well, we know how good a player he is. And obviously, Mahrez getting his hat trick as well. Do you know, they've struggled to get into those positions where, you know, you see those little cutbacks for Sterling to tap in, score those little 5 and 6 yard tap-ins that we've seen so regularly. They've struggled to do it. They struggled to do it massively against Spurs because Spurs were so deep and, you know, didn't allow any spacing behind them. But Burnley gifted them some of the goals. It gifted the ball away at times. There was space for them to exploit. And City, you know, I think they've been threatening to do it. And obviously, you know, that'll give them a bit of confidence in front of goal now as well.
Matt, what was the pick of the goals for you?
I liked all the goals. I mean, the one where he comes in on his left foot, it's a trademark goal, isn't it? You know, for Riyad Mahrez and bending it in off the post. I thought it was a really good performance from City, and one that they've needed. I think, you know, they've been, as I say, threatened to do it, needing a few goals, and obviously that will help them going forward now.
I've said it before and I'll say it again, I've already said it on this podcast, I think by the time they get to play Chelsea on the 2nd of January 2021, they will be up there alongside Liverpool and Chelsea and Spurs challenging for the title. I mean, that they had a difficult time at the start of the season. Everybody had a difficult time at the start of the season. They played later than a lot of other people, and also you have to remember the fixtures are a little bit imbalanced at the beginning of the campaign. They've got some tidy fixtures now, that's for sure.
Well, also they've had a difficult start, not just in terms of the belated return to pre-season, the congested schedule, but in terms of the actual matches that they've had to play as well. They've been to Tottenham, obviously, that they've had Leicester at home, they've played Liverpool. So yeah, listen, there's points to be won. I wish Pep Guardiola had picked Raheem Sterling, who was my fantasy league captain in this game, but you can understand why Mahrez got the nod when you talked about his record against Burnley. They've still got Aguero to reintricate into the team as well. So this, by no means, are Manchester City out of the title race. And you mentioned confidence. With this run, it's a good chance for them to really fill their goal-scoring boots and boost morale.
Who did you captain, Matt? Who was your captain in the end? Who did you go for?
Bruno Fernandes.
Oh, good idea. It worked for you. Okay. I went for Diego Jota. Worked for
nice.
Me too. Yeah. So, Crook, how many points did you get in the regular fantasy league this week?
45, I think, at the moment.
That's poor. That's poor. I'm well over 50 and waiting for two key players to play tomorrow as well. Come on, the Ollie Watkins. We'll get to those games. In fact, do you know what? Let's look ahead to Monday night's action now.
Towards the back post, and Vardy is there, of course he is, Leicester's greatest ever player.
We've made a good start, but for us, what's very important is just a continuation for us to be really honest in our approach in the game.
And Reid finished it off for his 4th of the season and brings Fulham level.
We can cause teams problems, we can be successful this year, I know that for sure. We are a very good team.
Leicester welcome Fulham on Monday night. And the last time Fulham won at Leicester was 16 years ago. Collins John scored both goals for a side that had Edwin van der Sar in goal. And Barry Howes up front, Matt. Ooh, any hope for Fulham here?
I don't think so. I would thoroughly expect Leicester to win. I think Brendan Rodgers has got a 100% record against Fulham as well. I think he's won 7 out of 7 against them. So, I expect Leicester to win.
Leicester involved in drama on Thursday night. Crook, I suppose he'll make changes for this one. Leicester have won the last 3 at home to nil in all competitions, and it's hard to argue against that happening again. If they do that, then they will be joint top with Spurs and Liverpool. Actually, if they win by 6 goals, they'll be top of the table, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility. Are they title contenders?
No, not for me. But they've had a good weekend with the three teams directly above them, all points. Southampton just behind them, dropping points as well. When you talk about title contenders, I think, again, squad depth comes into it. And there are certain players in that Leicester team that they can't afford to lose. Jamie Vardy
being one. Well, they have lost a lot, haven't they, over the course of the season. I mean, yeah, Soyuncu being one of them.
Yeah, but he's the key man, Jamie Vardy. They think Iheanacho, the jury is still out on him. And I think we're also celebrating the anniversary of Jamie Vardy smashing in goals in 11 matches in a row. We played your commentary of his goal against Manchester United on Darren Bent's Boot Room on Sunday evening. We were asking the question, where does he rank in terms of the top English strikers that the Premier League has ever seen? You've got to say, he's at least in the top 10. He could be pushing for the top 5 when you look at his remarkable backstory, the fact he's a title winner, and he looks as good now entering the veteran stage of his career as he has done at any point previously. And I think that's testament to the way that he looks after himself on the pitch and that off the pitch, and that decision to make himself unavailable for England duty. I think Leicester have certainly reaped the benefits.
Yeah, I mean, if you went to a cafe with him on a Saturday morning, I don't think you'd be that impressed with his pre-match meal. But then again, you know, it takes all sorts. West Ham against Aston Villa is the Monday night football. It kicks off at 8 o'clock. A West Ham win over Villa takes them above Southampton in the table. What a start to the season they have had, Matt Holland. They haven't lost to Villa at home since Darren Bent was in the Villa team 9 years ago.
Do you know, it has been a good start, and particularly, again, you look at their fixture list, West Ham, and some of the difficult fixtures that they've had. I always felt the bigger test for them was against teams that perhaps you'd expect them to get a result against. Because I think under David Moyes, they can be a difficult team to play against for the big boys. You know, they can sit back and cause you problems. Antonio's back in training as well, which I think is a big plus for them. But I think David Moyes would be delighted, particularly when you look at the difficult games that they've had, to be where they are in the table. This is a really fascinating game, actually. Looking forward to this one, because Villa are good as well. And then, you know, the start that they've had to the season, I think this could be quite an open game, this one. Difficult to decide who wins it.
Okay, Friday and Saturday night might have been pivotal junctions in the race against relegation.
It's Pereira. He is lifting that one towards the back post, and it does arrive at Bartley on the volley at the edge of the 6-yard box, and he puts it wide. Here's the corner again from Pereira. Edge of the box comes to Gallagher, who tries the shot and scores. Conor Gallagher from the edge of the penalty area, and West Bromwich Albion draw first blood in the basement battle. From the edge of the box, it came out to Gallagher, and almost in slow motion, he's put it into the bottom left-hand corner. Ramsdale holds his arms out. Not much he could do about that one.
It's a fantastic finish from Gallagher. Again, it was coming there he just passes it in, doesn't he? Just looking on the monitor now, just finds his spot. Great finish.
Now Brian coming forward on that left foot. Lovely ball, Cody. Lovely free header, and what a save by Johnson. That's brilliant. Burke with a header. Lovely ball in from the debutant Keane Bryan. Swung it in. Burke got the flick on it, and Johnson's made a terrific save, and that's out for a corner. Into the feet of McBurney. McBurney slips a lovely ball through. Burke inside the penalty. Cuts it back across. Bulldog! Oh, what a chance! From 10 yards out, Bulldog has put it over the crossbar by about 10 yards. What an opportunity. On his left foot, the back of the net should be ripped, but he's put it into the Smethwick end. Kravinovic, though, sets Pereira inside the box. Robson Kahn, who wants it, it's across to Furlong, who's arriving with a header, and he puts it over the top of the crossbar. What an opportunity for West Bromwich Albion to wrap up the points.
Let's start at the Hawthorns then. West Bromwich Albion beat Sheffield United in what was an absolutely thrilling football match to watch on Saturday night. It was proper Saturday night edge of the seat drama. You can have your Poirot, the wheel, the wall, the singing on a stool. 39 shots, saves, agonising misses. This was great entertainment. The problem for Chris Wilder is that a lot of his team's games are like that, Matt Holland, but they all have the same ending, don't they?
It's incredible. It's actually incredible. You know, 1 point from 10 games, I can't quite work it out. And particularly when you think about some of the chances that they had in the game at West Brom. I mean, wow. How have they not scored? I just don't know. I don't know how they've not scored.
Baldock, I don't know how he didn't score the goal.
No,
Mousset, I don't know how he didn't score the
Mousset,
goal.
Mousset, I'm scratching my head towards the end.
Ridiculous chances.
They haven't had a clean sheet. This is a team that was so good at the back last year. No clean sheet this season. Goals were an issue last year anyway.
Mm.
You know, so it was. This isn't something new.
They're creating more chances, aren't they? I mean, crikey.
We know they've had some problems at the back. They've had some injuries. They've had to readjust things. The goalkeeper's changed.
But they're not that bad, are they?
No.
I mean, that's the frustrating thing. If you're the owner of that football club and you're thinking, usually 10 games in, 1 point in the Premier League, you're going down. There's no chance of any way of you staying up because historically it's never happened before. You're like, change the manager. Let's start thinking about what we're going to do next season. But ultimately, you watch that. If you watch that team every week, you know that they're not as bad as their results are suggesting they are.
No, but they're still going down. There's no chance they're coming back from this. And you know, confidence, as we mentioned before, is drained.
Crookie, they're 5 points from West Brom, who are out of the relegation zone. How can you say they're not going to get out of it?
Because history tells us that the teams don't recover from this position.
It's another bold, crooky claim. The crooky monster strikes again, eating up statistics like he eats up bowls of...
I just can't see it. I had a
fried rice.
Prawn salad today for dinner, by the way.
Did you?
I can't see it. I can't see it. I think that the loss of O'Connell has been massive for them. As you say, they're leaking goals for fun, that they're missing chances. Confidence levels look through the floor. On the flip side, I was starting to write off West Bromwich Albion, but it was a massive win for them. I thought they played quite well at Manchester United the previous week. I think Gallagher in midfield is a player with Premier League class, and they haven't got too many of those. I give them a fighting chance of getting out of trouble, possibly at the expense of Burnley, because it is a four-horse race for me. Three from
already,
those four
yeah.
go down.
It looks like that, doesn't it? I mean, West Brom's Matias Pereira was absolutely superb in the game. He created 9 chances, which is the most by a player in a single Premier League game so far this season, the most since Kevin De Bruyne created 10 for Manchester City against Norwich in July. He was incredibly lively. You mentioned Conor Gallagher, I think. He's on loan from Chelsea. He's a decent player. But they've got goals, haven't they? I mean, they look like they've got marginally a more of a goal threat than Sheffield United, and that is important, Matt.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, ultimately, you can be a setup to be hard to break down, but the only way you're going to win games is by putting the ball in the back of the net. And so, yeah, of course, it's important. Pereira was very good. Keeper had a good game as well.
He did. He's done very well all season.
I like him.
So look, I think it's too early to write anybody, you know, out at this stage of the season
they're down.
You're
so desperate to just turn around and write people off. You know, it's out of order.
Well, the rot set in for Sheffield United before this season. We spoke about it post-lockdown, once the adrenaline had worn off.
Solskjaer getting rid of Sheffield United, telling Newcastle to stay in their box.
They actually, of all the teams in the Premier League, have missed the fans, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
Yeah, that's another
one team who hasn't missed the fans is Newcastle United. 2 minutes towards the end of the game, it was 0-0. It had been 0-0. It had been very much 0-0 all the way through. But the game was gone in 99 seconds at the end of the match, where Newcastle struck twice. Palace had 57% possession. But Matt Holland, they got out-palaced.
They don't win a game when they have more of the ball, Crystal Palace. No Zaha, no threat. You know, we just talked there about goals, and goals give you a chance of winning games. Well, Callum Wilson has been one of the best signings in the Premier League this season for me, because he offers them something, you know, that they haven't had for a long time. That threat in behind, he's a constant menace, he's a goal scorer. He's made such a difference to that Newcastle team. But as I said, you know, Palace without Zaha, just a no threat whatsoever.
Joelinton, whatever his name is, you have to say it right, because otherwise Newcastle fans get annoyed. He got on the score sheet just after Wilson. 16 games without a goal for Joelinton. How will that feel for him, do you think?
Well, I won't tell you what I was calling him on Friday night, because I had a little wager on Newcastle to win 1-0 and Callum Wilson to score the first goal.
I know you did. And I was so delighted when Joelington scored the goal. It made me so happy.
He's so rubbish, he can't even miss when he's supposed to. I think he is a player who puts it all out there. His work rate is incredible. I don't think you can question his commitment to the cause. So I was pleased for him in that respect that he got his rewards, just not for my ultimately losing bet. But I think Crystal Palace can count themselves fortunate. There are those four teams in the Premier League who are clearly worse than them, because as Matt said there, when Zaha doesn't play, they are struggling. I mean, they're a bad team when they win games. They're an even worse team when they lose them. And I do wonder if there will be a change of manager at the end of the season. Maybe the board before they want to go in a different direction. Because long term, I think it's Darren Lewis who uses the phrase, if you circle the drain long enough, eventually you fall down it. They are going to come unstuck, because there won't be three worse teams in the Premier League than them.
Yep. Okay, West Brom next for Crystal Palace. Looks like a key game for them. Newcastle have got Villa on Friday night. Right, that's it from us. We'll be back on Thursday afternoon with Darren Lewis in time for your commute back home from work to preview all the weekend's games in the Premier League. Thanks for listening. Please rate and review and subscribe and tell all your mates about Game Day from TalkSport.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.